Alrighty, let's see where we are today. A little bit of organized labor, some money in politics as well. Oh yeah, and an Egg McMuffin or two. Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great, as always, to have you along on this Thursday, everybody. It is the first day of October, and that means Detroit reported its September sales figure this morning. Happens the first of every month. Everybody did pretty well. Double-digit percentage gains pretty much across the board. Strong demand and easy credit did the trick. There is, though, another story of the car industry that bears some watching. For the first time in a generation, the United Auto Workers Union, rank and file, has voted down a labor contract negotiated by union leaders and the automaker Fiat Chrysler. And it wasn't even close either. 65% of workers voted no. The big issue is a two-tiered compensation structure that pays new hires far less than veterans get on the line. But as it turns out, the idea of first-tier and second-tier workers isn't really new in this economy. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
This big multinational company is in survival mode, trying to compete against non-union firms. So it pays new workers less, and the union grudgingly says, okay. It's 1983. Tom Cohan teaches at MIT's Sloan School of Management.
The airline industry, after deregulation, was among the first to introduce two-tier wages. American Airlines was the first one.
Then United, then Pan Am. The idea, how do I put this, it took off. The same way it has today with the big three automakers and the union parts suppliers and nurses and grocery store workers. But in each case, then and now, the new workers grumbled.
You're working right next to somebody who is getting paid 30% more than you.
University of Michigan economist Donald Grimes.
And has benefits that are worth far more than your benefits, and that doesn't make people happy.
Thus the gripe of the Fiat Chrysler workers, nearly half of whom are on the lower paid B team. But here's the rub. The two-tier system has made the company labor cost competitive with non-union rivals like Toyota. And if labor costs were to rise again, Art Wheaton at Cornell says Fiat Chrysler could simply close its U.S. plants.
It's very easy to start building plants in other countries, and then you try to have a race to the bottom and saying, well, if you don't do this, we'll move it all to China or Mexico.
There are no easy answers. The workers could also strike, or labor and management could start talking all over again. By the way, here's how it ended for the airlines back in the 80s. Two tiers became one. Not at the top level, though, but with lower pay and fewer benefits. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Yesterday was the end of the calendar quarter, fiscally for a lot of businesses, of course, but also for presidential candidates. The official campaign contribution reporting deadline isn't until October the 15th, but spin being everything in politics, some candidates released their totals today. Hillary Clinton raised more than $28 million. Bernie Sanders came in at $26 million. Ben Carson topped $20 million for the Republicans. But this being politics, fundraising is, of course, more than just numbers. Campaigns take the opportunity when these numbers roll around to, and let me borrow a political phrase here for you, be on message. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
The numbers are not just about the past, but also about the future. That's according to Ohio-based political consultant Bill Burgess. He has worked with Democratic campaigns.
In many ways, it's like corporate quarterly earnings. It's all about momentum. If you don't have positive momentum, just like people might not like your stock, contributors might not like your campaign. And that's why they become so important, because they drive the future.
And they drive the message. Hillary Clinton's campaign says that she's thrilled and grateful to have raised more than $28 million, but her rival Bernie Sanders fell just $2 million shy of Clinton's third quarter total. And that's a story, says Richard Brefault, a professor at Columbia Law School.
It's basically saying you should take us seriously. This is not a gadfly campaign anymore, but this is a campaign that he's one of the big boys, or big boys and girls, that he is up there with the others.
And Sanders' campaign is saying that most of his money came from small grassroots donors. Another candidate to announce his tally, Republican Ben Carson, who took in more than $20 million. Ron Christie is the CEO of Christie Strategies, a consulting firm in D.C. He worked in George W. Bush's administration.
It didn't take that long this morning for my inbox to explode with an email from Ben Carson saying it proves that outsiders are really in this game, that he has the strength to win and the strength to carry on.
Christie says the other candidates may not have released their numbers yet because the news isn't as good as they'd hoped. Or, here's another story, they might just still be adding up their totals. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
We were talking about politics and economic uncertainty yesterday. Remember that? Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said late this afternoon that he is going to run out of borrowing authority. That is the whole debt limit thing. He's going to run out of the ability to borrow more money come November the 5th, which is, by the way, soon. Tomorrow, though, is not soon. It's tomorrow, Jobs Day. September unemployment comes out at 8:30 Washington time. Wall Street was just marching in place. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Here is the marketplace metaphysical question of the day. If you show me an ad online and I don't see it, that is, I scroll on by it, it's on a page I don't really pay attention to, generally I can get away with ignoring it. If you do that, should the advertiser have to pay for that ad? Abstract theory, perhaps for you and me, very serious dollars and cents to companies that make money from online ads, Google, of course, being first among them. It is a big issue in that world, so big, in fact, that Google has just announced a big change in how it's going to sell its ads. It's only going to charge marketers for ads that are, and this is the company saying this, 100% viewable. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, we need to define some terms here, right? Viewability. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that advertisers actually want people to see the ads that they pay for.
Right.
That sounds pretty elementary, yes. But it's actually been a little bit of a problem. Ads are sold on a cost per thousand basis. That's what CPM stands for. You hear that term a lot?
I do.
And it means that there's a lot of incentive to put thousands and thousands of ads on various websites. Sometimes that means that the ad is way down low on a page where no one can ever see it. Sometimes it means it's way up high where you might only see it for a fraction of a second before you scroll down. If you're talking about video, that could mean that the video starts playing whether you want it to or not.
Yeah.
And that could count as a view. An advertiser would get charged for that. So what they're starting to say now is, hey, we want some metrics here. We want to know whether someone actually saw our ad and whether they saw it in a place that matters to them.
And so this is Google guaranteeing its advertisers, yes, people are going to see it.
Google is saying you will not pay for an ad unless someone saw it. And presumably, unless someone saw it on what's considered a high quality website.
One can see how that might be something of a gutsy move. I mean, yes, Google is Google, but really, they're only going to charge people for ads that are totally viewable?
It's a very gigantic move in the ad industry. I mean, it really is seismic. Facebook and Twitter have something a little bit similar in the last few months. They have announced the ability for advertisers to pay a little extra for ads that are 100% viewable. It's basically an option. But Google is now throwing down this gauntlet. It's setting a new standard for advertisers and for other publishers that is almost impossibly high to meet. It's something only Google could do because they have basically unlimited inventory.
Which is to say everybody on the planet wants to advertise through Google because they're Google.
Well, and Google has so many pages. Look, if you do a search on Google and you get back 17 billion results, any one of those pages can serve an ad. So, and then in this time of extreme uncertainty in the ad business, Google starts to look like a really safe place to put your ad dollars.
Is this mobile and desktop and everything, or is it one or the other? What is it?
It applies to mobile and desktop as far as we know. There are some specifics missing, which is sort of the interesting part of this. Google's thrown down the gauntlet, but in typical Google fashion, they haven't explained how much they're going to charge for these ads. They haven't explained how they're going to measure whether someone saw them and where they saw them. But mobile is a huge part of this conversation, so it absolutely includes mobile ads.
Marketplace and Molly Wood, making us smart on mobile viewability. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure.
Others may disagree, I'm sure, but sometimes there is nothing, and I do mean nothing better than a good egg muffin. I know McDonald's feels that way. Starting next Tuesday, the company is going to make some, not all, but some of its breakfast items available beyond the usual late morning cutoff. It's hoping those longer breakfast hours will help wake up its U.S. sales, which have been stuck for a good long while now. The catch is, this is a logistics problem as much as it is anything else. Marketplace's Andy Baxter looks at how it's going to work.
McDonald's has been toying with the idea of all-day breakfast for a long time. Customers like Lisa Jorgensen help you understand why.
Absolutely. When you want your Egg McMuffin, you want your Egg McMuffin. You know what I'm saying?
But there were reasons for McDonald's to hold back.
The main reason is we don't have enough room in our kitchens to cook everything at once.
This is a video posted to McDonald's YouTube channel last year. An Australian worker is explaining how tricky it is to keep offering breakfast items throughout the day when you've got limited grill and countertop space.
Because they're so busy at breakfast, some grills are dedicated to one food item only, such as eggs. Our ready-to-heat hotcakes also take up space which we need to make our burgers, as you can see right here.
But McDonald's U.S. franchise owners ultimately voted in favor of extended breakfast.
So you're going to handle the muffins?
All-day breakfast launched a few weeks early at this McDonald's. It's in North Branch, a small town in Minnesota. Predrag Dostanich is the owner of the place. He prefers to go by his nickname.
I'm Dos, okay?
Dos, okay. Dos says the changes have been easy to implement, partly because the all-day breakfast menu is limited. For example, restaurants will offer either a muffin or a biscuit sandwich, but not both.
Minnesota is a market where people like more muffin sandwich.
Dos and the store manager order up an Egg McMuffin to show how it's prepared during a dinner rush.
We're going to watch it come alive.
We're going to watch it come alive.
To avoid crowding the grill with breakfast foods, Dos has purchased some new equipment, including an extra egg cooker.
So that's it sizzling here.
McDonald's corporate helps cover some of the equipment costs, which run from $500 to $5,000. Now, things are not going perfectly with our Egg McMuffin. The worker overcooks the muffins. They're a bit burnt. Dos winces and says, "You're killing me.
You're killing me."
Now, to be fair, you can imagine the workers are pretty distracted with a microphone in their faces. And the sandwich actually gets assembled so quickly, I lose track of it.
So it is over here now.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, where is it?
Yeah.
Suddenly, it's ready.
There is no interaction. There is no issue.
But you can see the potential headaches, like having to explain to customers that they can't get any old breakfast item they want around the clock.
I really like the steak sandwich.
You would not have a steak sandwich.
And when someone orders breakfast at the drive-thru...
Two breakfast burritos and one sausage egg McMuffin.
She learns the sausage McMuffin gets made to order at this time of day, and it's going to take an extra 5 minutes. The customer frowns, changes her order.
No, let's do a third sausage burrito.
That last part, waiting for food,
yes,
is something
please.
Some McDonald's customers already complain about. Bob Golden is a food industry expert at the research firm Technomic, and he says as McDonald's adds more complexity with all-day breakfast, things could get worse.
The more products they add, it can have the effect of slowing down service time and increasing error rates.
But chain restaurant consultant Julene Beck says a key strategy for rejuvenating sales is to change up the menu. And if you do it by offering more of something people already like, namely breakfast.
It's as close to a, quote, no-brainer, close quote, as possible. It's not something that's unknown.
The other potential upside for McDonald's, breakfast food typically costs less than burgers to make. So increasing breakfast food sales can potentially juice profits. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you look at her, the inside crease of her elbow, you see a little divot, which is a scar from giving plasma so much.
Life in America on $2 a day. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 12 points today, less than a tenth percent, closed at 16,272. The NASDAQ up 6 points, a tenth percent, 4627. The S&P 500 also in positive territory, 3 points higher, two-tenths percent, 19 and 23. The later-than-usual Labor Day holiday helped boost auto sales. General Motors up 2.1%. Fiat Chrysler shares boosted 2.25%. That despite the contract thing we mentioned earlier. We talked yesterday about a report, no-name sources, mind you, that Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey was going to become the company's permanent CEO. No word yet from Twitter, but shareholders, plenty from them. Twitter down more than 8% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After American Pharoah and horse racing's Triple Crown this past spring, it's going to be interesting to see what happens next year when the Kentucky Derby rolls around again. But the fact is that for all the hoopla about the big races, the actual number of horse races run in this country every year is off about 40% or so since the early 90s. In some places, however, the sport of kings is hanging on, thanks in part to what's happening off the track. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan reports that the hottest thing in horse racing right now looks a whole lot like a slot machine.
If you want to bet on a horse race in Laramie, Wyoming, you go to Wyoming Downs, a little gambling parlor on the edge of town. Lou Shellhaas is a regular here, and today she's on a hot streak, up to $750 from a $10 bet.
Now this is when I should go home, right? But no, I'm going to spin the button again.
Shellhaas is playing Wyoming Downs' most popular attraction, a historical horse racing machine. These games have the lights and sounds of a classic casino-style slot machine. But while slots determine whether you win at random, historical horse racing machines are tied to the outcome of a past horse race. Before you hit the big bet button, you see a display of horse racing stats. And you're supposed to use those stats to pick your three cherries or dancing cowboys or whatever symbol the game uses. The only reason that this is legal is it's considered a game of skill. So you'd think a winner like Shellhaas would know a thing or two about horses, right?
I don't know a thing, you know?
Shellhaas says she basically just makes her picks at random. So does player Brandy Tamoxley.
Everybody don't know about it. Everybody just comes and plays the casino.
Historical horse racing machines are legal in some places. Traditional slots aren't. In Wyoming, that means gamblers don't have to drive to a Native American-run casino to play them. But even though the players might not care much for actual horse racing, the horse racing industry cares a lot about these players. There will be 32 days of live horse racing in Wyoming this year, like this sunny Sunday afternoon in the city of Casper. That's up from 4 race days before historical horse racing machines were legalized in 2013, says race operator Eugene Joyce. He owns parlors all across the state.
There would be no live horse racing in Wyoming if not for historical horse racing. And that's the simple fact.
In Wyoming and in most of the states with historical horse racing machines, only guys like Joyce, who actually put on live horse races, are allowed to operate and profit from these machines. His company, Wyoming Horse Racing, is projected to bring in about $11 million this year, 91% from historical horse racing machines. Joyce says the games are just a way to bring the thrill this afternoon in Casper to a wider audience.
Make no mistake, it's 100% horse racing, but it's packaged in a way to appeal to a new customer base.
Well, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. The bottom line is they are a slot machine.
Jim Conrad runs Wyoming's Wind River Casino on the Wind River Indian Reservation. He says places like Wyoming Downs cut into his business. Idaho lawmakers legalized historical horse racing machines 2 years ago, but recently banned them after a coalition of state tribes raised objections. Conrad says his casino is the largest employer on the reservation.
We have 800 employees. 90% are Native American, and if there's slot machines everywhere, it will affect the number of employees we have.
I never played a slot machine, but back at Wyoming Downs, I gave historical horse racing a whirl. Player Lou Shellhaas. Did I win anything?
No.
Maybe I'll have better luck at the races. In Laramie, Wyoming, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
When you talk about people living in extreme poverty, for the purposes of this discussion, $2 a day. You don't usually hear places like Chicago and Cleveland, Ohio being mentioned, but there are millions of Americans in those cities and others getting by on basically nothing. Catherine Eden from Johns Hopkins University and Luke Schaefer at the University of Michigan write about the poorest of this country's poor in their new book. It's called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. It's good to have you both with us.
Thanks,
Kai. Pleasure to be with you.
Catherine Eden, $2 a day is barely a gallon of gas. It's not even a gallon of milk. How is that doable? It's not doable.
Yes, that's interesting. You know, when we think about this threshold, we often think about the developing world where it's usually used.
Yeah.
Here we are in, you know, the nation's or in the world's most advanced capitalist country where you have to have cash to survive. But not having that vital resource of cash is profoundly disadvantageous for these families. Maybe in particular, the housing conditions. One family, Ray McCormick's in Cleveland, is doubled up with a number of other families in a derelict house in the Stockyards neighborhood. The house has been the victim of scrappers, so it only has one working outlet because the rest of the wiring has been pulled out of the walls. The copper pipes have been stolen. These kinds of living conditions are common because these people don't have enough money for to even buy their kids' socks and underwear, much less pay any kind of stable rent.
Luke, you write about it's an elaborate sort of sub-economy where some of these folks take their food stamp payments and whatever benefits they do get, and there's not a lot, and we'll get to that in a minute, but, you know, they take those electronic bank cards and they in essence, work out arrangements to get cash for part of the balance. They do the scrapping, right? They try to find metals. They sell plasma. Apparently, that's incredibly lucrative and easy to do, their blood plasma.
Yeah, what we really found was people were, from day to day, consumed with the work of getting just a little bit of cash, enough to maybe keep their families going one day. So there was a lot of, you know, you might say innovation and creativity. And as you said, we did see a lot of families trading or selling their food stamps. So they might go into a grocery store that they know does this sort of thing and ring through, say, $100 of fake groceries, and then the grocer would give them $60 in cash. And you can see where the problem is right there is that they're losing $40 of their purchasing power.
And that's the risk arbitrage cashier, right, for the grocer.
Yep, right, exactly. So blood plasma is a great example. So Jessica Compton down in Johnson City, Tennessee, she gives as often as the law will allow. If you look at her, the inside crease of her elbow, you see a little divot, which is a scar from giving plasma so much.
So, Kathy, let me ask you then about the safety net, about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Program, about TINF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Generally speaking, welfare. Why aren't these people getting whatever benefits are out there?
So this is the big question, right? Before welfare reform in 1994, TANF touched the lives of about two-thirds of the poor in any given year. Now that figure's down to 25%. Why this is so is a multifaceted question. Mm-hmm. Most poor people have not heard of TANF, at least in our sample. Ray McCormick actually went to the TANF office in desperation after months and months with no cash income. And she was told by a caseworker, "I'm sorry, honey. There's not enough to go around. Come back next year." Wow. And, of course, this is not what caseworkers are supposed to say, but more and more we're gathering evidence from states that caseworkers are engaging in these kinds of practices called informal diversions to keep the rolls low. And if they do that, by the way, the state can spend the block grant on other purposes. They're not required to spend it on TANF.
Luke Schaefer, this is a callous but, I think, necessary question. Why can't many of the people about whom you write just get jobs?
Well, this was maybe the thing that surprised us the most when we went into the field and started meeting families. I expected to find families who were just completely disconnected from the workforce, and in fact, it was completely the opposite. The families who we met thought of themselves as workers, had a history of work, but often because of the instability in the jobs that are available to them, combined with the instability in the support of family and friends that they have, you know, would lose a job. And it would be exceedingly difficult to find another one, especially combining that with housing instability. You know, things would just sort of spiral downwards. When you look at the jobs that are available, we saw very low wages, but perhaps more important, variable and unstable hours. I think we need to fix that because sometimes work just doesn't work.
Luke Schaefer is at the University of Michigan. Kathy Eden is at Johns Hopkins. Their book is called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today. No marketplace angle on this one, really. Just a number in light of the shootings at Umpqua Community College up in Oregon this afternoon. There have been, according to the website shootingtracker.com, 294 mass shootings in this country so far this year. That works out to more than one a day every single day of the year. All right, that's all we got. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.